Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. The United States has rejected allegations that new government legislation is in violation of conservation measures on the high seas fishing. The accusation from the ongoing chief executive of the parties of the Nauru Agreement is that the U.S. National Marine Fisheries Service last month allocated 1,828 fishing days for the U.S. Perseid fleet, while only 1,270 were allocated by the Tuning Commission last year. Transformer Kouros says the figure, which has been reached by combining 558 fishing days from its executive economic zones, allows its Perseid fleet to evade the commission measures. But the Regional Administration for NOAA Fisheries Service rejected the claims. Michael Tsusato says combining the limits is representation of the United States' full commitment to the conservation measures and not the other way around. Mr. Tsusato says the rule has been in application since the limits were first introduced in 2009, and it's fully compliant with both U.S. and international obligations. He told Karori Hawkins he thinks that it may be a big misunderstanding.
Clearly, he's failing to see the method and the rationale for how we've implemented this over the past several years. The measure requires the United States as a flag state to place limits on its Perseid vessels operating on the high seas. It also requires us as a coastal state to place limitations on our Perseid vessels fishing within our U.S. exclusive economic zones. The United States has nine U.S. economic zone areas around that are within the WCPFC area, in particular between 20 North and 20 South, where this measure is in effect. Some or all of our economic zone areas within that. It's not just the U.S. territories. It's the unincorporated areas around Howland Baker Island, Jarvis Island, Kingman Palmyra Island, Johnston Atoll, and the military island at Wake Island. All of those, not just our inhabited territories, are where we need to place these limits. So since 2009, we have had a limit in place within these areas. So that is, 558 days. That limit has been in place since 2009, and it's been reported to the commission since 2009. And that incorporates, our obligation to put that limit in place. In 2012, the additional requirement to limit our effort on the high seas was put in place by the commission. And it came about in a couple ways. It was a historic level, and then in 2013 or 14, it became a numeric level. And that's where his citing the 1,270 days. But those 1,270 days are not the only limits that the U.S. has to put in place. We have to put in both limits. And since 2009, we've been putting in those limits one time in a total for all U.S. Perseid efforts in the area. And that's because the intent and the objective of these Perseid effort limits are exactly the same. They are to limit Perseid effort in both of these areas. So we are living up to our obligation and living up, and putting in place our effort limits for both the high seas and the U.S. exclusive economic zone, which is what every coastal state has to do. Those two numbers, when added together, 1,270 plus 558, is the limit that we put into place. And we put that limit in place all-encompassing.
So it is, in your view, a misunderstanding of the representation of those numbers rather than any actual attempt to try and go around the system?
Exactly. We have two limits to put in place, and we've put two limits in place. And we've put those limits in place as one number.
Now, I understand the next meeting for the various countries in the fisheries and the U.S. will be in Auckland next week. Will you be raising this there?
Again, a little bit of confusion on the CEO's part. The next meeting of the WCPFC is actually not until December. Next week, the United States and the Pacific Island parties to the South Pacific Tuna Treaty will meet. This rulemaking has nothing to do with that. negotiation next week.
Right. Okay. So, just for a layperson, the distinction between those two is, if you can explain that a bit more.
So the distinction is you know, this rulemaking puts in place our obligations under the WCPFC, the convention that manages fisheries on high seas and within zones in the context of the Pacific-wide framework of our obligations. In a completely separate framework, the United States enters into a multilateral treaty with some Pacific Island parties to gain access to these exclusive economic zones of those parties. So it's a separate international instrument. This rulemaking has no bearing on that treaty.
The Foreign Fisheries Agency says the system for monitoring the region's fisheries is unsustainable and needs to change. A policing system has been heavily reliant on aid for more than a decade. A review of the program for the Foreign Fisheries Agency is being presented to the Pacific ministers in Solomon Islands next week. The agency's director, James Movek, says the system has been a huge success and the aim is to maintain quality while getting Pacific countries to carry out more of the cost. He spoke to Karori Hawkins.
This was the result of the director from the forum leaders at the forum meeting in Port Moresby last year. And they determined that the whole issue of fishing access and the monitoring, control, and surveillance has implications across a range of different government activities and interests. And so they directed that it be a joint review by ministers of fisheries, foreign affairs, and economic ministers, or finance ministers by and large. To that, we proposed, and it was agreed that we would add ministers in charge of police or of the maritime surveillance operations, the naval patrol vessels, etc. And that's the group that we have here represents this broad multi-sectoral approach to an issue that clearly does impact across government.
And what's the outcome of this? What is it that you're hoping to achieve with this?
Well, essentially, as we understand the leaders' directive, the ministers were charged with undertaking a comprehensive joint review of the regional MCS system in place, whether it's appropriate to our needs and how, you know, what sort of changes might be addressed for the future, to understand whether it is serving our current needs at the present time. So what we hope to get out of is a better understanding on the part of ministers, who would then be able to report back to the leaders as to whether their view of the sufficiency of the current operations, as well as areas where they think that there may be further work required and the types of resources or political support that may be required to undertake those.
Just finally, back to the monitoring, control and surveillance, MCS, as you were saying, the current model of it, though, the funding and the way it's working, are you happy with it? Is it successful in your view?
It's been successful, but it's relied heavily on donor development partner support. Increasingly, you know, donor funding is becoming more limited. And besides, many donors are saying, well, we've funding this for the last 10 years, you know, how are you going to sustain it? And those are legitimate questions. So we're looking at a higher degree of cost recovery. And that a large part of the effort that we will be undertaking with our member countries is to strengthen their national management capacities in order to manage their own surveillance programs to the extent they wish to or need to, and to derive a fair amount of cost recovery that allows them to cover their costs while not being unduly punitive or onerous on the boat itself.
And we're not talking just funding here. We're talking about some technical and logistical capacities that just don't exist in Pacific Island.
Oh, sure, yes. Yes, we're certainly looking at new technologies that are evolving, keeping an eye on those, and we'll seek to utilize those where they're appropriate and possible. We're looking at how to reduce the costs within our current systems. As we've gained more familiarity and experience with these, we realize that there are other ways to achieve the same outcomes more cost efficiently. And so we've been taking steps to reduce those costs. And we're also looking at increasing the training and capacity building of national officers so that they're able to be more effective in the implementation of their responsibilities.
A tourism operator in Palau says drought is over, but the jellyfish population has been declining rapidly. El Nino weather conditions caused widespread panic in the country, drying up water supplies and affecting one of the region's biggest attractions, Jellyfish Lake. Palau's Diving Adventures manager, Chris Loba, spoke to Lucy Smith about the recovery process they're going through.
Yeah, the initial impacts of the drought were severe water rationing. We were down to 2 hours of water per day, and sometimes there was no water. But since then, we've gotten enough rain, and we're back to, you know, the drought's been alleviated in Palau. You know, really the lasting environmental impact has been the effects on Jellyfish Lake, and we're starting to see a recovery even at that lake as we speak now.
And what has that meant for your business?
We had to kind of look over and update our, you know, crisis management plan. And, you know, that's kind of one of the last things you ever think about as a country you're working in and you have your business in, is that it completely runs out of water. But the restaurants were hit pretty hard. They couldn't wash the dishes, so they went to like paper plates and paper cups, things like that.
Did you notice that there were less tourists coming?
To a degree, I mean, it definitely impacted business. I mean, some people definitely canceled their trips. In fact, we stopped reservations, and if we only, the existing guests that we had, we kept, and we just monitored the situation. You know, we didn't want to burden the environment anymore, things like that, or make it worse. So we definitely turned away people. And we canceled some trips as well, you know, during that 1 month period.
And what's the situation like now?
We're back up to normal on the water. We're getting water 24 hours a day. The only lasting impact to Palau with this severe El Nino that came through has been the effect on Jellyfish Lake. You know, at one point we were down to only 5% of the jellyfish approximately that were left in the lake. But the scientists have gone up there, they've looked at it, you know, it is making a recovery, and we're starting to see some of the smaller jellyfish come back, and we're hoping for, you know, it should be a full recovery in the 1 to 2 year mark, and a substantial recovery in the next couple months. And El Nino's happened before in Palau, you know, maybe you know, about 20 years ago, and they had a similar problem at Jellyfish Lake, and the lake was able to make a full recovery. But, you know, the government and the scientists are definitely recommending that tour companies not go up there and, you know, kind of let the lake recover as much as possible.
An Australian aid agency providing help for Pacific disaster victims says La Nina weather pattern is a real threat for much of the region. The Pacific is still recovering from the debilitating droughts effects of El Nino. But CARE Australia's emergency response coordinator, Stefan Kollmeyer, says that if La Nina system develops, it would have the potential to impact people just as severely. He explained to Don Wiseman there could be a reverse of the experience of the past 9 months.
La Nina brings with it a large amount of rain for the vast majority of the Pacific Island countries. So many of the countries that have been experiencing a particularly strong drought period, Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, Fiji, Vanuatu, Tonga, these countries will receive or are likely to receive a large amount of rainfall that can lead to flash flooding and various associated risks like landslides if the La Nina system starts to take hold. So those countries that have been, you know, struggling with some of the impacts of dry period will now face potentially a significant amount of water.
And it's not always a lot wetter. It can actually have the reverse effect in some areas.
That's correct. So countries that have experienced a lot of water over the last 6 to 8 months, like Kiribati and Tuvalu, they will experience, if a La Nina does eventuate, a longer dry period, which of course is quite a challenge for those countries which are very reliant on rain for water. So for them, you know, a lot of our work over the coming months will be looking at how we can start to try and monitor and put some indicators in place, so monitor the amount of rainfall that the people are receiving, monitor some of those impacts so that we can actually start to see whether we are actually facing a particular dry period as months go by.
Care Australia's involved at the front lines helping people when they're affected, but you are also putting a lot of effort into preparation and disaster awareness, I suppose. So what are you doing as, with this possibility of a La Nina system about to hit?
In places like Vanuatu and in the south of Vanuatu, in Tafea province, across islands like Eremungo and Futuna and Aniwa, we've been working for many years with those communities. And what we're trying to do is identify some of the risks they may face when certain situations occur. So in a period of heightened drought, there are certain things that communities can undertake in terms of the kinds of crops they plant and the kind of repairs they can do to their water systems. And if they're facing certain risks like the cyclone season coming up later in the year, every year we know that happens, so we provide them training to communities around first aid or identifying some of the risks in their community, perhaps certain trees overhanging over houses, so practical things like that, locking those before the cyclone season happens, being aware that rivers can flood during, you know, events like La Nina, so perhaps considering moving some of your crops to higher ground so that you can have a sort of a fallback insurance policy should some of those lower-lying areas flood. So it's very practical things like that to provide the communities the skills to be the first responders should situations like this occur, and also try and minimise the risks that are associated with some of those climatic variations.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. A newspaper at the center of a storm is over. Its publication of an explicit photograph of an apparent suicide has now been printed, a fulsome apology. The Samoan Observer used the image of a Fatinfama woman who died in the suspected suicide on its front page. Police have made no official reports on the woman's death and have not released her name. Lucy Smith has more.
The woman was found in a church hall, and the picture published showed her at the scene. The chief editor of the paper, Xavier Sanor Malifa, has apologized. In a statement, he said that the paper had made a sad mistake and it has apologized to the woman's family in person. The newspaper has also published the letters of criticism they've received over the use of the photograph. Xavier Sanor Malifa says it is mainly people overseas who have taken offence over the use of the photo.
People die all the time. Journalists should go for the truth. And the truth is what we published. The funny thing is that there was very little response to the story from here in Samoa. Most of it came from overseas. That was where the criticisms came from, but here in Samoa it was very little.
The Pacific Island Media Association's Felicia Brown Acton says the publication had shown no moral compass by choosing to display such an image.
Samoa Observer obviously haven't been very helpful with the way that they've portrayed in an image of a young Fafafine transgender woman in Samoa. The reaction that it's caused has been quite a negative one in regards to how her death wasn't respected.
In a written statement, Samoa's Prime Minister Tuilaepa Sailele Malee Lengeoi added his support to the public outcry.
Like many others, I was appalled at the front page of the Samoa Observer showing a lifeless body of a young person with such callousness and disrespect. What the editor of the Observer has shown to Samoa and the world is that he is above any moral or professional obligation to report ethically and responsibly.
Pacific Freedom Forum's New Zealand correspondent Jason Brown says it is a case of the media not thinking it through.
The reporter is ordered to get all the facts, and that's what reporters are paid to do. It's then up to the editor to exercise editorial discretion and show some common decency, show some ethics, and not upset family, friends and the general public and further in what's already a deeply upsetting incident.
Jason Brown says suicide needs to be discussed rather than avoided, but this is a case of a media outlet clearly crossing the line. The Samoan Observer says it offers its humble apologies to the LGBT community locally and overseas, and says usually the newspaper is a strong supporter of the Fa'afine community. This is Lucy Smith.
A shortage of kava in Vanuatu's capital, Port Vila, has been linked to a recent severe drought that destroyed many young kava plantations. Furthermore, kava production is struggling to cope with an increased demand around Vanuatu Islands. Scientist from the Ministry of Agriculture, Dr. Vincent Lobbett, explains the situation to Johnny Blades.
Locally in the different islands of Vanuatu now, many kava bars are opening locally. So because of the inter-island shipping constraints, the producers, they tend to prefer to sell directly to the local bars. And consequently, in the capital, which is located on the island of Efate, where there is no kava production, it's true there is a shortage of kava supply, and the price of the shell is still the same. It's 100 vatu per shell. The problem is that the quality is declining because bartenders tend to dilute more the kava brew compared to what they used to do in the past. Instead of being satisfied with two or three, you might go for four or five.
You don't want it diluted, do you? It's just not the same kind of hit.
Well, exactly. This is not what we are looking for, because you don't want to drink kava for hours. What you are looking for, it's a quick, relaxing effect within a few minutes, and you want to socialize with your friends in the kava bars and to go back home in time. You don't want to stay in the kava bars for hours.
What can Vanuatu do about this shortage in the capital? Can anything be done?
True that we had serious drought events with El Nino, but I mean that farmers need to react promptly and urgently, because what happens when the price increases, some countries like maybe Indonesia, Papua New Guinea, the Solomons, or even Hawaii or New Caledonia will start considering growing kava locally, because for them it will become attractive to produce kava locally. They have not attempted to do so far, because it was still cheaper to import it from Vanuatu because the production and the quality were there. But if the quantity and the quality are not there anymore, then we might see some other countries being interested in kava production. And that will have an impact on the quality of the product on the international market, of course.
So, I mean, is there a dialogue with the producers around your country trying to look at what can we do with the situation now to become more resilient? How do we cope with this current shortage?
Well, the only way is to convince farmers to plant more, but because kava is propagated vegetatively with cuttings, there are some technical constraints. So what we are recommending to them is to establish nurseries in their villages that they can water properly, and to raise their young plants into plastic bags at the village level, and then to transfer the young plants to the gardens.
Staying in Samoa, the minister responsible for children in Samoa says he'll be seeking more funding to implement the recommendations of the United Nations Committee. A review in Geneva last week called for more work to protect children's rights in the country. The chief executive of Samoa's Ministry of Women, Community and Social Development, Beth Onzel, spoke to Karori Hawkins about the recommendations.
The committee have given us their recommendations, and we have agreed to adopt all of them. But basically, their recommendations are in line with the what has been given to us in the past. For example, the recommendation that we withdraw the reservation that Samoa has made to Article 28 of the convention.
That's on free education, right?
That's on free education. And there's a number of other specific recommendations that have been made by the committee, but we've had a look at all of it, and we've accepted them all because they are in line with the our program of work that we have set out for the next 5 years.
One of these things is to adopt a child care and protection bill. What's in that new piece of legislation or proposed legislation?
That basically provides for a comprehensive legislative framework to not only domesticate the CRC, the convention, and provide us with a comprehensive framework to set up a system for the care and protection of our children. So guiding principles in line with the guiding principles of the convention, and also setting up a system for to ensure the care and protection of children, especially when they are at risk. So the bill at the moment is being finalized, looking at final policy options for some of the areas that need resourcing and ensuring that we have the capacity and the systems in place to implement the Act once it's brought into being.
A section on violence against children, the committee applauds that the state has prohibited corporal punishment in schools and official areas, but it says that this could be strengthened to include banning it from use in homes and in the community.
That is the recommendation that was made by the committee, and we accept the recommendation that this is an area of that we need to work on. Our approach at the moment is that, you know, while it will be easy to put it in the law, and certainly that's a policy issue that's being considered at the moment under the Child Care and Protection Bill, our approach is that substantial change needs to be made through education and awareness raising and support to parents and to teachers and to everyone that's responsible for children, to ensure that they not only understand the fact that smacking children does not work to bring about desired behavior, but that there are alternative ways of ensuring that children, you know, be responsible, behave in a way that's respectful of others and don't hurt themselves and other people. So the legislative response option is being explored at the moment, but the focus in the past 2-3 years has been to do that training and do that awareness raising for parents and caregivers so that they have the tools to be able to raise children who are, you know, healthy, have initiative, have leadership and all of those things without having to smack them, because it simply does not work.
So across the whole spectrum, a positive report for you? Is that what you're taking away from this?
I mean, obviously, all of these reviews are about gauging where we are at and verifying, validating the priorities which we need to address. So a lot of the issues, in fact, all of the issues that the committee raised were things that we ourselves, going into the review, knew were things that had to be addressed and that we weren't doing quite so well in. And those have already been included in our, what we call our sector plan, which is basically the program of works for us for the next 5 years, which is guided by government's higher level policy and plans. So the process for us was really a validation and a verification of the progress that have been made, but more importantly, the gaps where we still need to do better and to improve outcomes in.
And of course, to do these things, you will need a technical, human and financial support. Will you be asking, is this a basis for you to ask for more funding for your departments?
Not only do we use these findings to advocate for resource mobilizations internally, but they also become the basis of our negotiation and our request for support from all of our development partners in their areas of expertise to help us out in the various for partnerships in the various areas of outcomes that need to be moved forward. So we already have some existing partnerships, and we're already working on some of these areas, but it's about ensuring that we continue to do justice in terms of resourcing to all of the spectrum of issues that need to be addressed as validated by the committee findings.
And that's all we have time for this week. Our email address, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Parent, wishing you well. Have a pleasant weekend. We'll see you again soon. Bye-bye.